Longstreet said, "Sir." He shook his head, groping for words. Lee waited. "Sir, there are some things I must say." Lee nodded, again without expression, immobile. The staff had moved back. The two generals were alone. Longstreet said, "Sir, my two divisions, Hood and McLaws, lost almost half their strength yesterday. Do you expect me to attack again that same high ground which they could not take yesterday at full strength, with so many officers lost, including Sam Hood?" Lee was expressionless. The eyes were black and still. Longstreet said, "Sir, there are now three Union corps on those rocky hills, on our flank. If I move my people forward, we will have no flank at all. They'll simply swing around and crush us. There are 30,000 men on those heights to our right. Cavalry is moving out on my flank now. If I move Hood and McLaws, the whole rear of this army is open." Lee's head shifted slightly, imperceptibly. His eyes shifted. He had been set. Now he turned, looked away, looked down at the ground, then east again. After a moment he said, "You say there is cavalry moving on your right? In what force? Two brigades, at least. You have that from Gorey?"
"Yes, sir."
Lee nodded. "Gorey is accurate," he said. He sat pondering.
"General," Longstreet said slowly, "it is my considered opinion that a frontal assault here would be a disaster."
Lee turned, frowned. The dark eyes flared for a moment, but he said nothing. Longstreet thought,
"I do not want to hurt this man."
He said slowly, "They are well entrenched. They mean to fight. They have good artillery and plenty of it. Any attack will be uphill over open ground.
General, this is a bad position. Have you ever seen a worse position? Here we are in a long line spread all around them, a line 5 miles long. How can we coordinate an attack? They're massed all together, damn near in a circle. Anywhere we hit them, they can bring reinforcements in a matter of minutes. And they can move up reinforcement behind those hills, out of sight of our cannon. But if we try to move in support, it has to come from miles off, and their cannon can see every move. Hell, their cannon are looking down at us right now. General Lee, sir, this is not a good position."
Lee said, "They will break." He said it very softly. Longstreet barely heard him.
"Sir? Sir?"
"They will break," Lee repeated. "In any case, there is no alternative."
"Sir, I do not think so." I am making him angry.
Lee turned and looked at him. But there was a difference in the face now. The weariness was suddenly apparent. The old man had lost control for a moment and the pain was there. The exhaustion dulled the eyes. Longstreet felt a surge of emotion. He wanted to reach out and touch the old man, but that was impossible. You could not show affection here. No place for it here. Too many men will die. Must think clearly. But all the while he felt an icy despair, a cold, dead place like dead skin. And then the guns began. Cannon booming off to the left, where Ewell was. Longstreet swung in his saddle, saw A.P. Hill coming up, chatting with Pickett, and heads all turning at the sound of the guns. And now Lee's face was aflame, an anger Longstreet had never seen before contorted the old man's face. He pulled his horse savagely, almost snarled. "What is Ewell up to? In God's name, can he follow no order at all?" Lee galloped off to the left. Longstreet remained behind. Pickett came up, good cheer in his eye, babbling that his boys had been up for hours, and what was the plan? Longstreet said,
"Nothing."
and they recognized the mood and left him alone. Fits of weariness began to pass over Longstreet, as clouds pass over and dull the heat. Colonel Marshall came back from Lee. The word was that the Federals had opened an attack on Ewell just as he was getting set. So, at least Ewell hadn't gone off half-cocked. No. But what does Lee expect? How can we coordinate across all these miles? And now Meade is attacking. Good. Very good. Meade begins to stir himself. Now that's excellent indeed. Given a bit of luck now, we can lure him down out of those damn bloody rocks. He's moving on my flank now. Good, very good. Let him come. Let him come. And then when his arm is out far enough, when his nose is extended, I will chop it off with a chop they'll feel in London. Lee was coming back. The sun was beginning to break through. The mist was rising. Lee rode slowly up, slouched a bit, no longer quite so trim. He smiled a haggard smile. Longstreet thought. He got mad at Ewell. Now he's embarrassed. Lee said, "No need for hurry now. General Ewell is engaged. General Meade has made a move. I must confess I did not expect it." He pointed. "We'll ride forward." They moved out toward the lines. Lee was thinking. Longstreet kept silent. The heat came slowly, steadily. They rode down to the Emmitsburg Road, in clear view of the Union lines. There were smells flowing up from the hospital. Out in the fields, the dead lay everywhere in the litter of war. Here and there, surgeons were moving, burial parties. Above them, on the Union lines, a cannon thumped. The ball passed overhead, exploded in an open field among dead bodies. Two of Lee's aides rode up, insisted that the Union gunners could see them much too clearly. They dismounted. Lee walked forward across the road into the peach orchard, where Barksdale had streamed to his death the day before. Lee cautioned Longstreet to keep his distance, so that if a shot came down, it would not get both of them at once. They were nearing the lines now. Men began rising out of the ground, ragged apparitions. The aides quieted cheering, which would draw Union fire. The men stood awe-stricken, hats in their hands, whispering kind words, words of hope, words of joy. Longstreet looked into lean, young, grinning faces, blood-stained clothes, saw bodies bloated in the fields, dead horses everywhere. Ewell's fight in the north was stiffer, but down here the sound was softened. The wind was in the south, blowing toward the battle, blowing up between the lines. They were walking now in Wofford's line. Wofford came out to greet General Lee. Wofford's brigade had pushed up the ridge almost to the top the day before. Lee listened to him tell of it. Then Lee said, "General, you went up there yesterday. Surely you can do it again."
"No, General, I think not," Wofford said.
He seemed embarrassed to say it. Lee said, "Why not?"
"Because yesterday we were chasing a broken enemy. They've been heavily reinforced. They've had all night to entrench. And my boys lost many friends yesterday."
Lee said nothing. Longstreet saw him clamp his jaw. He was walking slowly, hands clasped behind him. He said suddenly,
"Well, but Pickett is here. And Stuart. Don't forget Stuart."
A sharpshooter's bullet shirred by overhead. Longstreet looked for it curiously. Shooting downhill, snipers always overshoot. They were moving into the front of the line, the bloody wheat field. Longstreet saw a battery being moved, guns being pulled back. He saw a young Porter Alexander, his chief of artillery, in personal supervision.
"Good," he thought absently. "Very good. Alexander is seeing to it himself."
The technical commander was Parson Pendleton, but Pendleton was a fool.
There was high ground at the peach orchard. Alexander was posting some Napoleons there, waved as he rode by. Lee saw, approved wordlessly. He took his hat off, gazing upward at the long rise toward Cemetery Ridge. The sun gleamed on his white hair, the dark ridge along the brow line where the hat had pressed the hair down. Longstreet thought, he was not all that white-haired a year ago. He remembered yesterday. I'll tell you a secret. I'm an old man. I wish we could take the hill. Could flood right on over it and end the war. Wipe them all away in one great motion. But we can't. No matter how much I wish, or trust in God. Lee turned back. His face was again composed. He put the soft black hat back on his head. He called an aide, Venable, then Taylor. Longstreet waited to the side. Soldiers were drifting up to stand happily by, gazing with paternal affection at Lee, at Longstreet.
"Morning to you, General. You look pert this morning, sir."
"General, begging your pardon, sir, I'd like to complain about the food, sir."
"We's back in the Union now, General."
They were ready. That superb morale. Lee touched his hat to the men. They moved away from the line. The sun broke through at last and poured heat on the roadway. The mist was gone. A rider came up from Hood's division, commanded now by General Law. Law reported Union cavalry moving in force across his flank, suggested strengthening his line with Robertson's brigade. Longstreet agreed, Lee listening silently. Then they rode back toward the ridge where Pickett's men waited. Ewell's fight was going on. They could see smoke blowing now across the top of the hill. Ewell reported that Johnson was being compelled to fall back from the trenches he had won the night before. Lee sat alone for a while, Longstreet a small way away. A slowly growing swarm of aides and other officers, reporters, foreigners, musicians began gathering a respectful distance away. A band began playing that bonny blue flag in Lee's honor. Skirmish firing broke out in the fields below Seminary Ridge. Musketry popped in patches of white smoke as the lines felt and probed. At last Lee turned, summoned Longstreet. Longstreet came up. Lee said,
"General, we will attack the center."
He paused. Longstreet took a long breath. Let it go. "You will have Pickett's division. But I think you are right about the flank. Leave Hood and McClaw's where they are. I will give you Heath's division. It was not engaged yesterday. And Pender's." Longstreet nodded. "You will have three divisions. Your objective will be that clump of trees there." He pointed. The center of the Union line, the center of the ridge. The clump of trees was clear, isolated. In the center of the clump was one large tree shaped like an umbrella. Unmistakable. Longstreet nodded, listened, tried not to think. "Your attack will be preceded by massed artillery fire, a feu d'enfer. We will concentrate all our guns on that small area. When the artillery has had its effect, your charge will break the line. The rest of Hill's people will be waiting. Stuart has already gone round to the rear." Lee turned. Now the excitement was in his eyes. He leaned forward, gazing at Longstreet, hoping to strike fire. But Longstreet said nothing, stood listening, head bowed. Lee said, "Those three divisions will give you 15,000 men." Longstreet said,
"Yes, sir."
He stared at the ridge.
He said suddenly, "Hancock is up there."
Lee nodded.
"Yes, that's the Second Corps."
Longstreet said,
"Hard on Armstead."
Lee said, "You can begin at any time. But plan it well. Plan it well. We stake everything on this."
"Sir," Longstreet thought, "I can't." "Sir," Longstreet said,
You are giving me two of Hill's divisions, only one of mine. Most of the troops will be Hill's. Wouldn't it be better to give the attack to Hill? Lee shook his head. He said, General, I want you to make this attack. Longstreet took another deep breath. Lee said, General, I need you. Longstreet said, Sir, with your permission. Lee waited. Longstreet spoke and did not want to look him in the face, but did. Spoke, looking at the weary face, the ancient eyes, the old man who was more than father of the army, symbol of war. Sir, I have been a soldier all my life. I have served from the ranks on up. You know my service. I have to tell you now, sir, that I believe this attack will fail. I believe that no 15,000 men ever set for battle could take that hill, sir. Lee raised a hand. Longstreet had seen the anger before, had never seen it turn toward him. It was as if Longstreet was betraying him. But Longstreet went on. It is a distance of more than a mile, over open ground. As soon as we leave the trees, we will be under the fire of their artillery, from all over the field. At the top of the hill are Hancock's boys. Lee said, That's enough. He turned away. He called Taylor. For a long moment, Longstreet thought, He is relieving me. But Lee was sending for someone. Longstreet thought, He should relieve me. He should give it to A.P. Hill. But he knew Hill could not take it. No one could take it. There was no one else Lee could rely on, nothing else to do. It was all set and fated like the coming of the bloody heat, the damned rising of the damned sun, and nothing to do, no way to prevent it. My weary old man, God help us, what are you doing? Not thinking clearly anymore, Longstreet composed himself. Lee came back. Lee said calmly, General, do you have any question? Longstreet shook his head. Lee came to him, touched his arm. General, we all do our duty. We do what we have to do. Yes, sir, Longstreet said, not looking at him. Alexander is handling the artillery. He is very good. We will rely on him to break them up before Pickett gets there. Yes, sir. Heath is still too ill for action. I am giving his division to Johnston Pettigrew. Is that satisfactory to you? Longstreet nodded. Pender is out of action, too. Who would you suggest for the command there? Longstreet could not think. He said, Anyone you choose.
Well, Lee meditated, how about Isaac Trimble? No one in the army has more fight in him than Trimble.
Yes, Longstreet said.
Good. Then that's agreed. Pettigrew, Pickett, and Trimble. The new commanders won't really matter in an attack of this kind. The men will know where to go.
He went over the plan again. He wanted to be certain this day that it all went well, laying it all out like the tracks of a railroad. He was confident, excited. The blood was up. He thought the army could do anything. Longstreet felt the weariness, the heat of the day. The objective was clear. All 15,000 men would concentrate finally on a small stone wall, perhaps 100 yards wide. They might break through. It was possible.
Lee said, The line there is not strong. Meade has strengthened both his flanks. He must be weak in the center. I estimate his strength in the center at not much more than 5,000 men. The artillery barrage will upset them.
Yes, sir.
Is there anything you need? Take whatever time you need.
I have always been slow, Longstreet said.
There is no one I trust more.
If the line can be broken, Longstreet said.
It can.
It will. Lee paused, smiled. If it can be done, those boys will do it.
Longstreet moved back formally, saluted. Lee returned the salute, tall, erect, radiating faith and confidence. He said slowly, the voice of the father,
General Longstreet, God go with you.
Longstreet rode off to summon his staff. What was needed now was control, absolute control. Lee was right about that. A man who could not control himself had no right to command an army.
They must not know my doubts. They must not.
So I will send them all forward and say nothing, absolutely nothing, except what must be said. But he looked down at his hands. They were trembling. Control took a few moments. He was not sure he could do it. There had never been anything like this in his life before. But here was Pickett, wide-eyed, curious, long hair ringed and combed, mounted on a black horse, under a great tree. Longstreet told him the orders. Pickett whooped with joy. Longstreet let him go off to form his troops. He looked at his watch. Not yet noon. It would be some time yet. He sent for the other officers, for Porter Alexander. The fight on the far left was dying. Ewell was done. There would be no support there. He felt a moment of curious suspension. As when you have been awake for a long time, you have certain moments of unreality, of numbness, of the beginning of sleep. It passed. He heard cannon fire to the left, closer. A.P. Hill was shooting at something. Alexander rode up, a young man, nondescript face, but very capable. He was excited, hatless. He apologized for the loss of the hat.
Sir, we seem to have upset Colonel Walton. He has just reminded me that he is the senior artillery officer in this corps.
Longstreet moved out to the edge of the trees. He indicated the limits of the attack, where the fire should converge. He explained it slowly, methodically, with great care. The Union cannon up on the rocky hill would cause trouble. Alexander should assign guns to keep them quiet. He should have more guns ready to move forward with the attack, keeping the flanks clear. It occurred to Longstreet that this was a grave responsibility. He interrupted himself, said suddenly,
How old are you, son?
Sir? 26, sir.
Longstreet nodded, looked into the unlined face, the bright, dark, anxious eyes.
Best gunner in the corps. We make do with what we have.
He said,
Can you clean those guns off that hill, son?
Sir? Well, sir, I don't know about that, sir.
Well, Longstreet said.
He thought,
I'm seeking reassurance. Let it go.
He said,
I am relying on you, son.
Yes, sir.
Alexander bobbed his head several times, kicked the turf.
I'll sure keep him shooting, sir.
Don't open fire until I give you the word, until everything's in position. Then fire with everything you have. Get yourself a good observation point so you can see the damage we're doing. We've got to drive some of those people off that hill. If we don't do that, I'll rely on your judgment.
A great weight to put upon him, but nothing else to do. Alexander saluted, moved off. Here came Sorrell, bringing with him on horseback Generals Pettigrew and Trimble. Longstreet greeted them, sent for Pickett. He got down from his horse and walked over to the open space on the ground where the staff had spread the camp stools and asked for coffee. They sat in a circle, lesser officers at a distance, almost in files, by rank.
Longstreet wore the expressionless face, drank the coffee, said nothing at all. Looked at them. Johnston Pettigrew, handsome, fine-featured, an intellectual. Very few intellectuals in this army. He had attended the University of North Carolina, and they talked of his grades there with reverence and awe. Curious thing, Longstreet thought. He smiled slightly. Here's our intellectual, Pettigrew, going into battle side by side with old Pickett, last in his class. He chuckled. The men were watching him, sensing his mood. They seemed happy to see him grin. Longstreet looked at Pettigrew.
Tell me you've written a book.
Sir? Oh, yes, sir. Firm sound of the voice, clear, calm eye. Lee thinks the world of him. He will do all right.
What was it about?
Oh, it was only a minor work, sir.
I'll have to read it.
You will have a copy, sir, with my compliments. To Longstreet's surprise, Pettigrew rose, summoned an aide, dispatched the man for the book. Longstreet grinned again. He said,
General, I doubt if I'll have time today.
At your leisure, sir. Pettigrew bowed formally. Longstreet looked at Isaac Trimble. He was breathing hard, face red and puffy, a bewildered look to him. He had a reputation as a fire breather. He did not look like it. His beard was fully white, his hair puffed and frizzled.
Well, Longstreet thought, we shall see.
Pickett came up, joined the circle. Introductions were unnecessary. Longstreet ordered coffee all around, but Trimble would not take any. His stomach was troubling him. Sorrell was the only other officer to hear the orders. Longstreet explained it all slowly, watching them. Pickett was excited, could not sit still, sat rubbing his thighs with both hands, nodding, patting himself on the knees. Pettigrew was calm and pale and still. Trimble breathed deeply, rubbed his nose. His face grew more and more crimson. Longstreet began to understand that the old man was deeply moved. When he was done with the orders, Longstreet drew the alignment in the dirt. They all understood. Then Longstreet rose and walked out to the edge of the trees, out into the open, for a look at the Union line. He pointed to the clump of trees. There were a few minor questions. Longstreet told them to keep that clump in sight as they moved back to their troops, to make sure there was no confusion. The attack would guide on Pickett. More minor questions. Then silence. They stood together, the four men, looking up at the Union line. The mist had burned away. There were a few clouds, a slight haze. Hill's guns had stopped. There was a general silence.
Longstreet said, Gentlemen, the fate of your country rests on this attack.
All eyes were on his face. He put out his hand.
Gentlemen, return to your troops.
Pettigrew took his hand.
Sir, I want to say it is an honor to serve under your command.
He moved off. Trimble took the hand. He was crying. He said huskily, tears all down the red glistening cheeks.
I want to thank you, sir, for the opportunity you have given me, sir, to serve here. I have prayed, sir.
He stopped, choked. Longstreet pressed his hand.
Trimble said, I will take that wall, sir.
Pickett stayed. Longstreet said,
George, can you take that hill?
Pickett grinned. My curly boy. He rushed off, hair flying. Here was Alexander, galloping up through the trees, exasperated.
Sir, General Hill's artillery is dueling the Union people for some damn barn, sir. Excuse me, but it's a tragic waste of ammunition. We don't have a limitless supply.
Longstreet said,
Give General Hill my compliments and tell him I suggest he reserve his ammunition for the assault.
Alexander rode off.
And so it's in motion.
Seminary Ridge was thick with trees, but the fields on both sides were bare. Pickett's troops were beginning to form in the fields to the west, out of sight of the Union line. Longstreet rode to watch them, then back out through the trees to face east, looking up toward the Union line. His staff was with him. Gaunt Gorey asleep in his saddle, refusing to lie down. Longstreet saw a familiar figure standing some distance out in the field, alone, looking toward the Union line. He rode that way.
Armstead, looking up toward Hancock's wall.
Longstreet stopped, nodded, let the man alone, rode away.
Poor old Lowe. Well, all over soon. One way or the other.
Lee was coming back down the line, aides preceding him to keep the men from cheering. Alexander's guns were moving, realigning. Horses were pulling caissons into position, stirring the dust. Lee was trim and calm, all business. He suggested they ride the lines again. Longstreet agreed, silently. Pickett rode up, asked to accompany them. All the attack would guide on Pickett. It was necessary there be no mistake at all. The three men rode together along the front of the dark woods, in front of the cannon, the troops. The woods behind them a dark wall, and the long, flat green rise in front of them, spreading upward and outward to the Emmitsburg Road. The rise beyond that, the visible breastworks, the stone wall near the crest, well named Cemetery Ridge. Lee discussed the attack with Pickett. Longstreet was silent. There was a dip in the ground near the center. They rode down out of sight of the Union line. Lee was telling Pickett how to maneuver his troops sideways when he reached the road, so that they would converge on that clump of trees toward the center. He had many suggestions as to how to use the ground. Longstreet dropped slightly behind them. They came out into the open again, in front of the point of woods from which Lee would watch the assault. Longstreet looked up the long rise. He could begin to see it. When the troops came out of the woods, the artillery would open up. Long-range artillery, percussion and solid shot, every gun on the hill. The guns to the right, on the rocky hill, would enfilade the line. The troops would be under fire with more than a mile to walk. And so they would go. A few hundred yards out, still in the open field, they would come within range of skirmish, aimed rifles. Losses would steadily increase. When they reached the road, they would be slowed by the fence there, and the formation, if it still held, would begin to come apart. Then they would be within range of the rifles on the crest. When they crossed the road, they would begin to take canister fire, and thousands of balls of shrapnel wiping huge holes in the lines. As they got closer, there would be double canister. If they reached the wall without breaking, there would not be many left. It was a mathematical equation. But maybe the artillery would break up the defense. There was that hope. But that was Hancock up there, and Hancock would not run. So it is mathematical after all. If they reach the road and get beyond it, they will suffer 50% casualties. I do not think they will even reach the wall. Lee asked his advice on artillery support. Longstreet gave it quietly. They rode back down the line. A quietness was beginning to settle over the field. The sun was rising toward noon. They came back toward Longstreet's line. Lee said,
"Well, we have left nothing undone. It is all in the hands of God."
Longstreet thought, "It isn't God that is sending those men up that hill." But he said nothing.
Lee rode away.
Pickett said earnestly, "Sir, How much time do we have?
Terrible question. But he did not know what he was asking. Longstreet said,
Plenty of time. The guns will fire for at least an hour.
Pickett slapped his thighs.
It's the waiting, sir, you know. Well, sir, I think I'll have the troops lie down. Then I'll write to Sally.
You'll see it's delivered, sir? Longstreet nodded. Pickett rode off. Nothing to do now but wait. The guns were in line. The caissons were stacking shot, the gunners digging their small trenches. 140 guns, and the Union boys will reply. It will be the greatest concentration of artillery ever fired. Longstreet got down from his horse. He was very, very tired. He walked toward a cool grove of trees. Sorrel and Gorey followed, but Longstreet waved them away. He sat with his back against a tree, put his head in his hands.
There is one thing you can do. You can resign now. You can refuse to lead it. But I cannot even do that. Cannot leave the man alone. Cannot leave him with that attack in the hands of Hill. Cannot leave because I disagree, because, as he says, it's all in the hands of God. And maybe God really wants it this way. But they will mostly all die. We will lose it here. Even if they get to the hill, what will they have left? What will we have left? All ammunition gone, our best men gone. And the thing is, I cannot even refuse. I cannot even back away. I cannot leave him to fight it alone. They're my people. My boys. God help me. I can't even quit.
He closed his eyes.
From a tree close by, Colonel Fremantle saw him. Thought he was resting before the great battle. Could not help but wonder at the enormous calm of the man. What an incredible time to go to sleep.
3. Chamberlain. Past Little Round Top, the ground dipped down into a saddle, but the line ran straight, unbroken, along the saddle and up the ridge, rising toward the trees and the cemetery, that northern hill. The line was a marvelous thing to see. Thousands of men and horses, and the gleaming Napoleons row on row, and miles of wagons and shells. Marching along the crest, they could see back to the Tawnytown Road, and the rows of tents, the hospitals, the endless black rows of more cannon, wagon trains. The sun was hot along the ridge, and men had stuck bayonets in the ground and rigged shelter halves, and here and there through scarred trees they could see down into the rocks below. Bodies there in black clumps, soft among the gray boulders. Back in the woods of Little Round Top, up on the summit of the hill, they had been alone. But now they were in the midst of the army, the great army. A moving fragment of this unending line of men and guns, lined along the spine of that ridge going out of sight to the north. Chamberlain gathered strength, limping along the ridge, tucking himself in under his soft black hat, out of the sun. The lieutenant who was their guide was a dapper young man named Pitzer, who liked to gossip, to show that he was privy to great secrets. He had a runny nose, and he sneezed repeatedly, but seemed to be enjoying himself. He pointed out the place where the 1st Minnesota had made the charge that had the whole army talking. 300 men had charged under Hancock's direction. Only 40 had come back. But they had broken a Reb assault, giving reserves time to get up. Chamberlain thought, their casualties much worse than mine. In a fight, it always seems that your fight is the hardest. Must remember that. What happened to them was much worse than what happened to us. Pitzer said, conversationally, We very nearly retreated this morning. Retreated? Why?
Chamberlain was aghast.
Meade wanted to pull the whole army out. Had a meeting of corps commanders last night. He really did. Pitzer sneezed emphatically.
Damn ragweed! Happens every some...
He exploded again, plucked out a bright red handkerchief, wiped his nose, his wheezy eye, grinned. Meade wrote an order for the whole army to withdraw, then held a meeting of corps commanders and asked for a vote. This army is great for meetings, Colonel. Old Sedgwick did the right thing. He fell asleep. Pitzer chuckled. Old Uncle John. You can count on him. He voted, then he fell asleep.
What was the vote?
Well, hell, all the corps commanders voted to stay. I mean, the only one felt like pulling out was Meade. General Meade, he added thoughtfully, eyeing Chamberlain. Never knew how to take these civilian colonels. It was unanimous. Meade had him write it out, so it's all on record. I was watching through a window, saw the whole thing, even old Sedgwick asleep. Now there's an officer. Him and Hancock. Pitzer shook his head admiringly, wheezing. Hancock was something to behold. He says they'll come again one more time, and we ought to be right here, waiting.
He says they'll come again? Hancock?
Yep.
Where did he say they'd come?
Pitzer grinned, pointed, wheezed. Why, Colonel? Right about here. They were moving higher up the crest of the hill. They were coming out in a long space of open ground along the crest before a grove of trees, the cemetery. Down across the field there was a small farmhouse surrounded by horses, flags, many soldiers. Chamberlain could see, even at this distance, the high brass. To the left was a clump of trees, a stone fence, two batteries of artillery, the long line of troops lying in the sun, in the shade of the trees, dug in, waiting. Pitzer said, pointing,
"That's Meade's headquarters, over there. Position of your regiment will be back there, down near the road. You'll be in reserve behind the crest. Don't have to dig in, but don't go away."
Pitzer led them down the grass, pointed to a flat space just above the road, the masses of guns and wagons, in plain sight of the headquarters.
"Here it is, Colonel. I'm to place you here. Colonel Rice will be by in a bit. Says you are to report to General Sykes later on."
He saluted, sneezed, wandered off in no great hurry, wiping his nose. Chamberlain placed the regiment. They sat in the field, in the sun. There were questions about rations. Chamberlain thought, all those wagons down there. There ought to be something. He sent Rule Thomas out to scrounge. Brother Tom went off to find the hospital, to see how the boys were, to see how Buster Kilrain was getting along. Chamberlain smelled coffee, the lovely smell of cooking chicken. He tried to follow his nose, was interrupted by another odor. He climbed a stone fence knee-high, saw a shallow depression filled with dead horses, dragged there to get them off the crest, legs and guts and glaring teeth beginning to smell. Wind still luckily from the south. Chamberlain went back across the stone fence, looked up toward the crest. Couldn't see much from here. Could sure use some food. Felt incredibly lonesome. No one to talk to anymore. Sat by himself. The men around him were rigging shade, collapsing. Ellis Spear came up, sat down, said hello, fell asleep. The sun was too much. The men were moving with slow, drugged movements. Chamberlain thought, any minute now I will go to sleep. Dreamy, Lee. He smiled. Did not want to sleep. Food. Get some fuel. Mustn't sleep. A rider. Man stopped before him. Chamberlain squinted upward. Message from General Sykes. Would like the pleasure of Colonel Chamberlain's company. Chamberlain squinted. Where is he? The rider indicated the crest, trees at the far end. Chamberlain said,
Haven't got a horse, but I guess I can make that.
He staggered to his feet. The rider, solicitous, hopped down, offered him the horse, led the animal by the bridle, making Chamberlain feel boyish and ridiculous. Chamberlain took the reins, woke Ellis Spear, told him to take over. Spear agreed blearily. The messenger led Chamberlain up the crest. Past a clump of trees to his left, the view opened. He could see a long way down across open fields to a road, a farmhouse, a long sweep of wheat rising up to green woods on the far ridge, at least a mile off. Lovely country. Heat shimmered on the road. Chamberlain thought, must be 90. Hope my next war is in Maine, where I will fight Dreamy Lee. Owe her a letter. Soon. Kids be playing now, sitting down to lunch, eating. Cold, cold milk. Thick white bread. Cheese and cream. Oh. He rode up into the shade of the trees. Sitting there ahead was Hancock. Chamberlain perked up, straightened his uniform. He had seen Hancock only a few times, but the man was memorable. Picture book soldier. Tall and calm. Handsome. Magnetic. Clean white shirt. Even here, white cuffs. Hat cocked forward, slightly jauntily, shading his eyes. He was sitting on a camp stool, gazing westward intently. He moved. His arm came up. He was eating a piece of chicken. He was surrounded by generals. Some of them Chamberlain recognized. Gibbon, of Hancock's corps, the cold man with the icy reputation. He had three brothers with the South. How many out there today, across that silent field? There was Pleasanton, of the cavalry, and Newton, new commander of the First Corps. Chamberlain saw a vast pot of stewed chicken, a pot of hot tea, a disappearing loaf of battered bread, some pickles. His mouth opened, watered, gulped. The generals went on eating mercilessly. The messenger took Chamberlain on past the food to a dark spot near a white barn. General Sykes was sitting there, smoking a cigar, staring down at some papers, dictating an order. The messenger introduced him as he dismounted, then departed with the horse. Sykes stood up, extended a hand, looked him over as you look over a horse you are contemplating buying.
Chamberlain! Yes. Heard about you. Want to hear more? Want you to write a report. Rice says you did a good job.
Chamberlain nodded and said thank you, and went on smelling chicken. Sykes was a small, thin, grouchy man, had the reputation of a gentleman, though somewhat bad-tempered. Chamberlain thought, there are no good-tempered generals. Sykes said, observing Chamberlain with the same look one gives a new rifle, Rice says you're a schoolteacher.
Well, Chamberlain said, not quite. You aren't regular army.
No, sir. I taught at Bowdoin.
Bowdoin? Oh, you mean Bowdoin. Yes, heard of it. Amazing.
He shook his head.
Tell me you ordered a bayonet charge. Drove those people halfway to Richmond.
Chamberlain shifted his feet idiotically.
Well, I'm going to look into it, Colonel. And let me tell you this. We need fighting men in this army, any way we can get 'em. Regular army or no, and one damn thing is sure, we can use some brigade commanders. I'm going to look into it. Meantime, well done. Well done. Now you go rest up. Nothing going to happen today.
He was finished, turned back to his work.
Chamberlain asked about rations. Sykes told a lieutenant to see to it. Chamberlain saluted, backed off, out into the sun.
No horse now, have to walk.
right foot on fire. Damn. He limped along the crest, not paying much attention to the view. He was a picturesque figure. He had not changed clothes, nor washed, nor shaved in a week. His blue pants were torn in several places and splotched with dried blood. His right boot was torn. His jacket was ripped at the shoulder. His sword was without a scabbard, was stuck into his belt. He hobbled along painfully, sleepily, detouring around the front of a Napoleon. Didn't notice it until he opened his eyes and looked straight into the black maw, the hole of the barrel. Then he blinked and came awake momentarily, remembering Shakespeare's line, "The bubble reputation in the cannon's mouth." Doesn't look like a mouth. Looks like a damn dangerous hole. Stay away from that. He was passing the group with Hancock and the chickens. He sighed wistfully, smelling fresh coffee, looked that way, was too proud to ask. Saw a familiar figure, Meade himself. A crusty old stork, munching on a chicken leg. Chamberlain paused. Never saw much of Meade. Didn't quite know what to think of him. But if he wants to retreat, he's a damn fool. Chamberlain had stopped. A number of the group of officers noticed him. Chamberlain looked down, saw blood coming out of his boot. That keeps up, I'm in trouble. Foot wounds always slow to heal. Wonder why. An officer had detached himself from the group. Chamberlain had started to move on, but the officer came up, saluted. He was older than Chamberlain, but he was only a lieutenant, sitting with all the generals. Chamberlain could feel the massed power. It was like being near great barrels of gunpowder. The lieutenant asked if he could be of service. Chamberlain said, "No thanks," wondering how to conquer pride, and if a general would part with some chicken. And then felt ashamed, because his boys had none, and would be guilty to eat something up here. But on the other hand, don't get something soon and keep losing blood, might pass out, in all this damned heat, like you did the other time, and be no good to anybody. The lieutenant introduced himself. Frank Haskell, aide to General Gibbon. He recognized Chamberlain's name. His eyes showed respect. Now that was pleasant. Chamberlain explained that he'd been to see General Sykes and had no horse, and the foot was bothering him, and did the lieutenant think they might spare one scrawny leg or even a neck? The lieutenant bowed, came back with three pieces of chicken, hot and greasy, wrapped in a dirty white cloth. Chamberlain took them with gratitude, staggered off down the hill. He ate one piece, preserve the other two. It was awful, but marvelous. When he got back to the company, he gave the two surviving pieces to Ellis Spear and told him to figure out a way to share them with somebody, that rations would be here soon, Sykes had promised. He rested and took off his boot. Nothing to wrap it with. He tore a bit off his shirt, was working away diligently, saw Tom coming. Tom was losing the chipper edge. Chamberlain thought, be all right in a bit. The young recover quickly. Must think on the theology of that, plugging a hole in the line with a brother. Except for that, it would all have been fine, an almost perfect fight, but the memory of that is ajar, is wrong. Some things a man cannot be asked to do. Killing of brothers. This whole war is concerned with the killing of brothers. Not my family. He thought of Gibbon. Praise be to God. Must send Tom somewhere else. In that moment, Chamberlain made up his mind. Tom would have to go. Tell him soon. Not now. Tom sat, lines in the face. Something wrong, Chamberlain saw. Kilrain? Lawrence, I've been down to the hospital. God-awful mess.
No shade, no room. They're lying everywhere out in the sun. They're cutting off arms and legs right out in the open, front of everybody, like they did at Fredericksburg.
God, they ought to know better. They ought not to do that in public. Some of them people die. Men ought to have privacy at a time like that. You got to yell sometimes, you know.
Lord. Did you see Kilrain? Tom nodded. He sat with his back against the wall, the small stone wall this side of the dead horses, plucking grass. He sighed. Chamberlain said, How is he?
Well, Lawrence, he died.
Oh, Chamberlain said. He blinked. The world came into focus. He could see leaves of the trees dark and sharp against the blue sky. He could smell the dead horses.
He died this morning before I got there. A couple of the boys was with him. He said to tell you goodbye and that he was sorry.
Chamberlain nodded.
It wasn't the wounds. They said his heart gave out.
Chamberlain had stopped wrapping his bloody foot. Now he went on. But he could see the weary Irish face, the red-nosed leprechaun.
Just one small drink. One wee pint of the cruel.
Tom said, I tell you, Lawrence, I sure was fond of the man.
Yes, Chamberlain said.
Tom said nothing more. He sat plucking grass. Chamberlain wrapped the foot. The moment was very quiet. He sat looking down at his bloody leg, feeling the gentle wind, the heat from the south, seeing Kilrain dead on a litter. No more the steady presence. Sometimes he believed in a heaven. Mostly he believed in a heaven. There ought to be a heaven for young soldiers. Especially young soldiers. But just as surely for the old soldier. There ought to be more than just that metallic end. And then silence. Then the worms. And sometimes he believed, mostly he believed. But just this moment he did not believe at all. Knew Kilrain was dead and gone forever. That the grin had died and would not reappear. Never. There was nothing beyond the sound of the guns, but the vast dark, the huge nothing. Not even silence. Just an end. One sharp report, one single cannon. His head turned unconsciously to listen. A long flutter. The ball passed over, exploded on the far side of the road, along the edge of the hospitals there. He saw white smoke, splintered wood. He sat up. Another gun, one single shot. And then the long roar as of the whole vast rumbling earth beginning to open. Chamberlain twitched around to see shells beginning to come over, falling first on the left, then almost instantly on the center, then to the right, then overhead, air bursts and ground bursts and solid shot. There was a blaze in the air obliterating his sight, hot breath of death, huge noise. He was rolled over in dirt, came out on his knees, face down, very, very close. He looked down, around, amazed. Tom was near, flat on the ground, all right, all right. He saw other troops behind boulders, molded into depressions in the earth. The world was blowing up. Had been under artillery fire before, but never like this. Am I all right? Sat up to probe. Found self intact. Looked out over the wall. Saw no one moving anywhere. Moment ago there had been men moving all along the crest, men sitting and wandering and riding horses, artillery moving here and there, a wagon, a caisson. Now they were all gone, as men vanish from a busy street when rain comes. There was burst after burst in the dirty air, yellow lightning shattering the ground, splintering rock, ripping limbs off the great trees and sending them twisting, swirling, dancing along the ground, along the ridge. but no man anywhere, no man at all, as if the whole army had suddenly sunk into the earth. There was a